today we're in for a real treat. I have the great privilege of introducing Dr. Roland McCrady. Dr. McCrady is Director of Research at the Institute of HeartMath. He is also a professor at Florida Atlantic University, and he's an expert in research and development, systems engineering and instrumentations design. He's undergone advanced training in electrical systems engineering at NASA Space Center. He has a bachelor's degree in technology, a master's in radiational physics, and a PhD in health services. Dr. McCrady and his research team regularly participate in collaborative studies with other US and international institutions, and his research has been published in journals that include the American Journal of Cardiology, the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, Stress Medicine, Biological Psychology, and many more. He's been interviewed in leading news publications, national TV shows, and appeared in numerous documentaries. So, Dr. McCrady, we're thrilled to have you on the summit, and a warm welcome to you.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Nikki.
Fantastic. So I'm truly excited to interview you today because your research is good, it's profound, and it has huge implications and is highly relevant for our audience. So what I wanted to do is just start. We've had a theme on this summit around this kind of model of stress and fatigue are based around the kind of more classical understanding of psychoneuroimmunology. So we're talking about exposures to kind of stresses that become hardwired in the brain and have this cascade effect downwards through chronic stress in the nervous system affecting the endocrine and then the immune system, and that can lead to kind of serious mitochondrial malfunction in the more serious cases of chronic fatigue, for example. So it's a kind of top-down model, and it's mainly in a biochemical paradigm. So what I would like to invite you to do is share your research on the heart and how that's going to slightly explode that model.
Well, okay, I'd be happy to do that. I mean, you are right in a way. I wouldn't say we're going to explode the top-down model because it is an important part of the puzzle, but it's only part of the puzzle, as I think you're alluding to, Nikki. Because we'll call it the bottom-up processes, are quite powerful, and in many cases are what's missing from a lot of approaches to really being able to better self-regulate our energy and these types of things.
Fantastic. So, in particular, let's just talk about sort of examples of the heart kind of affecting and communicating upwards to the brain.
Okay. For the listeners, a very basic kind of introduction to this. I think it's important to understand first that the heart and brain are more interconnected and communicate more so than any other two systems in the human body. And there are four primary ways that the heart communicates information to the brain and body, not just the brain. One of those that we'll talk a little bit about is neurologically through the nervous system. In fact, what I'm about to tell you will be surprising to a lot of people, but it's actually been known since the late 1800s. It's a basic anatomical fact, and that is that the heart sends far more information to the brain than the brain sends to the heart. In fact, if we look at the vagus nerves, which are the primary nerve pathways, there's two vagus nerves, of course. They're very large nerves, thousands of fibers in each one, and 90% of those neural fibers are carrying information from the body to the brain, and the majority of those are quite literally coming from the heart and cardiovascular system. So for many of the last quite a few years, you know, since the brain-dominant paradigm shift, we've really been focused on the 10%, which is the top-down part. So we'll talk more about that in a moment, but that's one of the primary ways the heart and brain communicate. And biochemically is another. In fact, the heart was reclassified in the mid-1980s to be part of the hormonal system when it was discovered that the heart secretes hormones. And there's been quite a number of those that have been identified now. The first one to be identified is now called atrial peptide. It's been called different things over the years. And that tends to be nicknamed the balance hormone because it has a balancing effect on the vascular system. There are receptors in the brain for it and so on. And in fact, when we have higher atrial peptide, it blocks the stress response at the level of the adrenal glands. We don't secrete as much cortisol and stuff. The most recent, there's a whole lot more, but the most recent one, I think the funnest one that's really appropriate, is oxytocin. In fact, the heart produces as much oxytocin as the brain. And for those that aren't familiar with oxytocin, I think most are these days, but the media loves to call it the love hormone or the bonding hormone because it's the hormone that even small releases of have long-lasting effects on our relationships. So it's pretty appropriate. I bet you didn't, well, I don't know if you're married or not, but you probably didn't tell your significant other, I love you with all your head, hopefully, Nikki, right?
No.
So you follow what I mean there.
Yes.
Then also energetically is another way that the heart communicates, not only with the brain, but the whole body, and as we'll talk about, I suspect, in this interview, the heart, the feel of the heart, actually the magnetic field, literally reaches out and affects others in our environment. And if we have time, we'll even get into how it even connects us with the greater earth field itself. And then the fourth way is biophysically, which we won't go into a lot of detail there.
I think what I find really interesting is the way that how the heart specifically seems to lock into parts of the brain like the amygdala and the thalamus. Is that neurologically as well as electrically?
Oh, it's definitely neurologically. Well, I guess electrically kind of goes along with the neurologically. So there, as I mentioned, there are all these, technically the term is called afferent, but ascending neural pathways from the heart through both the parasympathetic system, which is the vagus nerves, and through our spinal column, through the sympathetic chains, both the number of neural pathways flowing up from the heart to the brain, primarily the vagus nerves. And it's been observed since the late 1960s, 1970s, a lot of research was done in the field of psychophysiology, which is my field, that showed that not only was the heart sending all this information to the brain, but that the quality, we'll call it, of these signals, the pattern to these signals has profound effects on brain function, on mental functions. Now, in fact, in the older writings from back then, they're literally saying that the heart is acting as though it has a mind of its own. Because that's what it made its own decisions. In other words, the heart can override the signals coming down from the brain. And that's really important for our own survival, that it can do that. Because sometimes, if we got really angry at somebody and we keep driving the heart to go faster and faster, if something a little more intelligent didn't finally come in and say, no, hold the phone here, you drive yourself into an arrhythmia and die. So it's a good thing there is this local intelligence within the heart. So back then, what they didn't know was that within the heart, the human heart, it's now nicknamed the heart brain. And this is information, this isn't me, this is from the field called neural cardiology. So we now know that the human heart has what's called the intrinsic cardiac nervous system, that's the technical name, but it's basically the brain and the heart. And that's not a metaphor. That term was coined because all these neural systems in the heart really qualify to be a functional brain. I won't go into all the anatomical detail, but it's a very complex, interconnected neural system that has all the same functions and features you would expect in a brain. Neuroplasticity, short-term memory, long-term memory, neurogenesis, and so on all exist in the heart. But these signals that are sent upstairs, there are direct neural pathways to really all of the major brain centers. And some very strong and direct ones, they first come up to the medulla, which is the brainstem area. And then there's direct and very strong neural pathways to the two centers you just mentioned, Nikki, the thalamus and the amygdalas. And those have really important roles. Now, before I explain that, the term was given back in the early 1970s to describe the effects that the signals from the heart were having on our brain function, mental functions. They called them one or two terms, either cortical inhibition or cortical facilitation. So, as well, I'm sure we'll get to as well, but this is part of the story here. In a healthy person, our heart rate changes with each and every heartbeat, and that's called heart rate variability. And we can go into the importance of that a bit more later, but in a healthy person, even when we're asleep, people are sitting still listening to this now, their heart rate is constantly varying. And the way I'd like to suggest we think about this is the analogy of Morse code. So most people know that, in the time between things, in Morse code, we encode information, and it can be quite complex information depending upon the nature of the message. Well, that's the strategy. Think of that as the strategy that the nervous system, really the whole nervous system, uses to encode information. It all has to do with the time between things, even within between neurons. It's the information is all encoded in the time between the neural spikes. So the heart is doing the same thing, just on a much more global scale, because that information through the magnetic field and all these other neural pathways, literally affects every cell in our body. So it can act as a synchronizing signal, if you will, the master information distributor, if I can put it that way. So when we have disordered patterns in the heart rhythm, and that's what we naturally are creating, when we feel things like irritation or frustration, impatience, especially anger or anxiety, these types of emotional states, that creates a very disordered-looking heart rhythm pattern. And what I'm about, it's really quite simple at the end of the day, the way this all works, but it took a lot of researchers a lot of years to sort it all out and really get it all verified. But the story's pretty clear. So when you have these disordered, or what we call incoherent heart rhythm patterns, that disordered message, that signal is going directly to the thalamus, which is the very core of our brain. And the brain is organized in layers around that. We only have one thalamus. It's the very center of the core of the brain. And one of its roles is to synchronize the electrical activity of all the neurons in our brain, including the cortex and the frontal cortex and these, you know, where executive functions exist and so on. So when we're in that incoherent state, it basically, these erratic signals interfere with the thalamus's ability to synchronize the electrical activity of the entire brain, and that was what they labeled cortical inhibition. Now that's actually really easy to measure in things like reaction times, coordination, visual field tasks, things like that, and that's been done in labs all over the world since the 70s. Now, on the other hand, what we've found is that when we're in a positive state, we're appreciating, God, what a beautiful day it is, right? Or those feelings of connection with other people, love, compassion, kindness, the heart naturally goes into a much more ordered and what we call coherent rhythm. This is where it pictures worth a thousand words, kind of like a rolling hills kind of pattern versus this earthquakey, jerky pattern. And the term that was given back to that pattern all the way back in the 70s was the one I mentioned earlier, cortical facilitation. The brain works better because it facilitates the thalamus's ability to synchronize electrical activity. So even though the easiest ways to measure this is things like reaction times and coordination, the part of the brain that's most profoundly affected is the frontal and prefrontal cortex. And the skills that gives us are what Carl Priebum would call them executive functions. He coined that term. But it's basically foresight, the ability to understand and know how our actions in the now affect the future. So planning, goal setting, discrimination of appropriate behavior. Probably not a good idea to, you know, hit the boss if we want to keep our job, right? Abstract thinking, all these types of things. So those are pretty refined abilities, and it's pretty easy to understand that the neural machinery, if you will, that underlies those capacities, when they're out of sync, those are the ones that are taken offline most profoundly. And this, you've probably never done this, Nikki, but a lot of people either know people that have, maybe, is that we might get, we're in a conversation with a friend, a spouse, colleague, whatever. If you have teenagers, you can probably relate. They say or do something, it just, you know, frankly, gets us a little angry and upset. And then about a minute later or 30 seconds later, we're saying to ourselves, oh my God, I can't believe I just said that or did that. you mm-hmm. blurt out the thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you relate at all?
No, never.
No, I didn't think you would have ever done that. Well, and then I would usually ask the question, why? Well, how many of you have done that with the same person around the very same issue more than once? You know, that usually gets a laugh because, of course, we've all done that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But what I just explained was the physiology of it. This is really fast-acting stuff. So when we feel that anger or that frustration, it literally inhibits our brain. So we blurt out the thing. It ends up causing a lot more stress, a lot more energy drain, especially in the context of fatigue. And we've activated all of the stress, you know, the stress hormones and all that autonomically mediated stuff. So if we're able to get into a coherent state, we actually facilitate all those same functions above and beyond our normal walking around state. So suddenly we have more options. We have more, what seems like more inner time in our inner world to have that choice point between the beginning of the reaction and the blurt out. Like an inner prompter can come in and say, wait a minute, that's probably not going to be a good idea if I say that in this situation.
So this is, it's really profound just listening to you, because it just shows how much, even how smart we are, is led by the heart and whether we're in a coherent state or not. And something I've heard you mention before is about sort of this idea that the brain may be more of a kind of a recording system of actually what's going on from the sort of being led by the heart. So rather than sort of originating in the brain, it's the heart that takes the lead. And then you talked about the brain is a kind of eavesdropping on what the heart's doing and then imprints it.
Well, exactly. Now, this is not saying heart over brain, by the way. I just need to say that for reference here. I'm glad I've got a brain. I want it to work really well because the brain does what it does. And it just happens that also bringing the heart into the equation, the brain can really be the big winner here and come out and be a lot smarter. Now, to what you're talking about now, Nikki, so the other pathway we mentioned earlier is there's a direct neural connections once these neural signals come up from the heart to the medulla. So we talked about the thalamus. But there's also direct neural pathways to the amygdala, or amygdalas, we should say. In fact, the core nucleus, the centers of the amygdala, are literally synchronized to the heartbeat. So every time the heart beats, the cells in the core of the amygdala fire in unison with it. So whatever these patterns, rhythmic patterns are, that Morse code information, right, is clearly getting to the amygdala, and it's monitoring those signals. Now, I'm going to make a long story short here, but basically, what we're starting to see now and understand is that the amygdalas, as you just indicated, are interpreting the signals from the heart and other parts of the body, but primarily the heart. Now, interestingly, they're in our face, we have 40-some muscles that we have unconscious control of, you know, like we smile or we frown. There's also neural systems that feed information back to the brain that reflect the patterns of our facial expressions. And they connect in to the amygdala exactly the same place that the inputs from the heart do. So in reality, it's our face, the inputs from the body, face and heart especially, but other systems, breathing rates and hormonal rhythms and all this, create this backdrop that the amygdala is basically eavesdropping on or monitoring, that has a very large role in creating our emotional experience, how we actually feel. So this is a major part of what I was talking about by bottom up. So it's very hard sometimes to do willpower to regulate ourselves, our emotions, and so on. Most people have had the experience of a New Year's resolution. You know, how long do they normally last, right? Usually not very long. As soon as we forget about them, we're back into our old habit patterns. Now, the reason that this happens is the way that this tends to work, or does work. So you've got the amygdala, and it's associated neural circuitry. It's not just the amygdala, but we'll focus on it because it's kind of the center of this. So when we have these inputs to the amygdala long enough where we hang out in a certain state, that creates what's called a familiar baseline reference pattern. So once that's, the way the brain works is it's always analyzing patterns of information, and it works on comparing things. So the brain is comparing the now current inputs to the familiar baseline that we've established. And it looks for the match or mismatch. And when there's a big mismatch, it gets our attention. Kind of a common example is we don't typically feel our heart rate or our heart beating until the heart rate gets really high or really low. It gets out of the range of the familiar, and then that gets our attention because it's a big mismatch. Mm-hmm. Now, this same thing works for creating emotions, the same idea. It's kind of a complex thing, but I'll try and make it simple. So if you're, well, here's a key understanding, Nikki, is that what becomes the familiar baseline is what we experience from an emotional perspective as comfortable. Okay? So you might know children that everywhere they go, they create chaos. Mm-hmm. You know, right? Mm-hmm. Or you might know some adults like that. but usually when you find out that in whatever their environment's been, that they're in a chaotic environment, either their peers or whatever, to where that's become their baseline. So they have to be acting out and doing this stuff to feel comfortable.
Wow.
Or people, let's say, that are anxious all the time or worried or, you know, tend to get frustrated quick. That's to become their familiar, and that's where they're comfortable.
And is that, so for example, if somebody had a lot of trauma and stress for a period, then that's obviously the heart is registering that. And then is it the, if over time the amygdala can kind of record that and do a reset so that that becomes the baseline? Is it kind of the amygdala which is resetting the baseline in response?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh,
absolutely. So you can have a baseline can get established. Then the more typical way is through just, you know, repeated patterns, right? Like, I worry a lot because I'm not caring if I'm not worrying, right? I mean, how ridiculous is that? But a lot of people feel that. That's their inner experience. Or it can happen through a traumatic event, especially if it has strong emotion associated with it. So that can quickly create a baseline. We have many different types of baselines. So that's, but this is an adaptive system, which is good and bad. So for example, kind of a common example, we'll take PTSD for somebody that's in law enforcement, that's really in a, like an inner city thing, or we see a lot what's going on in law enforcement these days, but our military, where you really are in an environment that your life is at risk, where you really have to be hypervigilant and really, you know, alert and all the stuff that you have to be. So that the system adapts and that becomes your new baseline, right? Mm-hmm. And it's adaptive, it's predictive. But now what happens when you go home or you're in an environment where you don't need that, but they really, that's their baseline. So that to be comfortable, they're in that hypervigilant state. So it's maladaptive in that case.
That's so interesting.
Does it make sense?
Yes, it's fascinating. And it's so applicable to what we see that happens in many chronic fatigue patients as well, which we'll expand on a bit more later. But
well, exactly, because if you're in that hyper state, even though it feels normal and comfortable, right, you start losing awareness because of the familiarity of what it's doing to our body. And it, basically, you're using energy. At the end of the day, this is really all about energy management.
Yep.
So there is no such thing, from my perspective, Nikki, as a sustained change or behavioral change, especially without shifting that baseline.
Right.
Okay? And as it turns out, that being in a coherent state is one of the most rapid ways to do that. And there are other processes that are also very helpful. So I'm big fan of a lot of different techniques that help, in my way of thinking, that give people a jump start, kind of like jumper cables on a battery to jump start a car when the battery's low, right? Its energy's low. Those are very helpful. But if you don't give people their own set of tools and techniques to start better self-regulating their own energy and becoming more intelligent about our own energy expenditures, the battery just runs down again, and it's just constant having to get the jump start.
Right? Yeah.
Rather than coming up with ways to recharge our own inner battery, as we call it.
And reset, yes.
But resetting is an important part of that, absolutely.
So can I ask you to, I'd like to expand about heart rate variability and this what you've talked about is a mathematical relationship between emotions and the heart. And one of the best ways of measuring the heart and the health of the heart and your emotions as well is this heart rate variability. Do you want to expand a bit more about that?
Oh, happy to. So, and this is, it's kind of upside down from what doctors were taught not that many years ago, say 20 years ago now. And that is that in a healthy, resilient person, our heart rate changes with each and every heartbeat. And that's what's called heart rate variability. Of course, heart rate is just how many times does the heart beat in a minute. But in reality, it's the heart rate is changing with each and every beat. And that's what's called heart rate variability. Now, as it turns out, we have more of this natural intrinsic variability when we're young, and it gets less and less as we age. In fact, it's such a strong relationship to aging that we can measure a person's HRV, how much of it they have, and tell within about 2 years how old they are, if they're on a healthy aging trajectory. Now, if we've had a lot of trauma, we have a lot of stress in our life, we're using more energy than we're recovering. Again, it's all about energy, right? that's reflected in lower HRV, what's lower than it should be for our age. Now, that's really important because low HRV, again, for our age, I'm going to quit saying that, but always know that I'm talking about age-related HRV, is a stronger predictor of future health problems. In fact, it's correlated with what's called all-cause mortality. So if our variability is low, that it's a better predictor of future health problems and death from any cause than all of the standard things people keep hearing about, right? Like high blood pressure and cholesterol and smoking and all that stuff. So it's a really important inner fundamental rhythm. In fact, many of us in the research side of this consider the measurement of the amount of HRV we have as a measure of resilience, or resilience. So within resilience, that concept, you know, which is really our energy, how much energy we have in our inner battery, that's primarily regulated, if you will, over longer time periods by our own ability to self-regulate, to be in control of our emotions. And that's so important because if we look at the hierarchy of what goes in our body, it's the emotions that run the show. They're what drive the hormonal system and the activity in our nervous system and so on. So if we're in these incoherent states a lot, which translate basically to impatience and frustration and, you know, these kinds of feelings, we're constantly draining our inner battery until that becomes our new baseline, and we've depleted ourselves to where it's harder to recover from.
And that's amazing. Just to back up what you're saying there, I saw Dr. Dean Ornish, the great pioneer in lifestyle medicine for the treatment of patients with heart disease. I saw him speak at the Personalized Lifestyle Medicine Institute Consortium recently. And of course, he's talking about his research and, you know, we've covered obviously exercise and diet and the low-fat diet and so on. But he literally made the point that it was whether a person felt loved or not, or whether they felt isolated or not, that factor was more important than the others. So it's so important. It's amazing that turns out to be, you know, the more important than everything else. It's wow.
Right. So I'm just maybe hopefully here helping add some of the physiological reasons for that. Because when we are more loving and feeling more loved and connected, that is what drives, if you will, the systems in our inner body. You know, when they're more coherent just means they're more aligned, they're more resonant, they're more, all of our inner systems are cooperating with each other instead of fighting each other. So that adds energy to our inner battery instead of depleting it.
Can I just quickly ask, is that HRV wouldn't be affected by things like chemicals, exposure to chemical or kind of gluten?
Sure it can be.
Oh, okay.
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah, so the HRV is a great measure of overall system function. And how, so there's two different levels. There's how much of it we have, and then there's, which is really amazing, so there's the how much, okay, which is predictive of future health, our resilience, self-regulatory capacity, these things. But then if we take a deeper look at HRV, there's, independent of how much of it we have, the patterns that are all constantly changing and going on reflect our current state. Okay, so when we're frustrated, like I mentioned earlier, it becomes a very jerky-looking pattern. When we're in that loving state, like Dr. Ernest is talking about, it becomes very coherent. And that's literally reflecting how synchronized the activity in our nervous system and brain is. Okay, so there's two levels here. So anything that depletes our energy, like exposure to a toxin, especially over time, is reflected in lowered HRV or a more chaotic HRV pattern. And so in fact, we've actually done research in populations with chemical sensitivity and these types of things. Now that's a whole other story we probably don't want to get into here, but HRV is a wonderful measure of these types of things, both on the current level, you know, short-term level of what our current state is and the long-term health effects.
Wow. So when we start to consider about getting into sort of ways that we can improve our HRV, it's not just that we would want to be using, some of the machinery that you've created, which we'll talk about in a second, to help balance emotions. But it's also things like we would need to address if somebody is exposed to chemicals and has gluten sensitivity. Those things obviously should be assessed and removed from the environment so that it's another factor to consider.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
I think a really great metaphor here, again, I've been using, is to think of, we all have a certain amount of energy we wake up with. And then this is a metaphor, sort of, but it's kind of literal as well, is that we have an inner battery. And we, that's what resilience is. How much charge do we have in that inner battery? So it really, especially as somebody who's depleted their inner battery, it really gets down to what are we doing that drains energy versus what are we doing to add energy to that inner battery. So both are really important. Of course, you have to have the right diet and the right food substances to, because that's part of what the cells do, right? The mitochondria makes food into electrons, it's energy. But we also have energy in different domains, like a mental type of energy. That's a very real and measurable thing. Emotional energy. These are all real things, right? And they all have different qualities.
So that's actually what you've just done there. It's really beautiful, actually, because it's brought together just about everything on this whole summit. So it's made it, we've now brought together all the other speakers, the ones where we're talking about gluten sensitivity. It's why we're doing that, why we've talked about chemical sensitivity, all these different aspects of diet. And then we're covering all the emotional aspects, because certainly within fatigue as well, sort of adverse childhood events, emotional trauma in childhood is highly correlated with onset of chronic fatigue in later life. And adverse childhood events are like, they're saying now 67% of adults are affected by this. So it's one of a range, but it's a very important one. So this aspect of actually kind of changing our and getting into a coherent state and helping to clear the emotional trauma is also a really important factor.
Yeah, I thought, being you said that, can I add a little bit here?
Go.
All right. So we do a lot of HRV analysis. We do it for clinics all around the world, actually, a formal clinical HRV assessment that doctors do, and then we send them back a report. And we started, I'm going back a few years here, observing through our conversations with the physicians we work with, that later in life, we get into our 40s and 50s, that a particular type of the heart's rhythm, when we look at HRV, it's kind of complex, and it's all these different internal rhythms, but a particular rhythm called the VLF rhythm tended to be low in people with early childhood trauma or adversity. And I was talking, talking to one of my colleagues or friends that does a lot of HRV research at Emory University, who we were having a conversation. He said exactly the same thing. We've been seeing early childhood trauma reflected in low VLF HRV later in life. And this was a mystery at first. We were like, what the heck is going on? Well, what we now know is that this particular part of HRV is reflected when is highly correlated with, you will, or associated with, when we have high inflammation, inflammatory processes. And it's a type of systemic inflammation that's not always obvious. This all came full circle, and make a long story very short here, with the work that's been done on epigenetics, especially out of UCLA, that is now pretty convincingly shown that both loneliness, which you also mentioned earlier, and early childhood adversity lead to epigenetic changes in early childhood that downregulate immunity and upregulate the processes that create inflammation. Now, when we're young, we're still, physiologically speaking, pretty resilient. So it takes time for those processes to finally wear down the inner battery I was talking about. So later in life, we're seeing that now reflected in depleted batteries, basically, as reflected in lower HRV.
Wow. So that's a question I was going to ask about the link between inflammation as well. Fantastically interesting. Okay. Because that links it all together in how they found, inflammation in the brain, inflammation in the digestive system and so on, and chronic fatigue and stress-related conditions. So fantastically interesting.
And we see low HRV and chronic fatigue as well, of course.
Yes, of course. So let's, and one of the issues, we've got this kind of standard, the conventional treatment approach, which is things like cognitive behavioral therapy that's recommended for stress. And I mean,
top-down process, yes.
Yes, and words, using words rather than, how effective is thinking and words versus, these other techniques. And perhaps that's where we can talk a bit about some of the, yeah.
Well, from my observation from doing research for many years, and I'm not down on cognitive approaches, don't get me wrong here, But they, frankly, they just don't work very well in a lot of populations. And so it's really hard for the mind to manage itself, the mind to manage the mind. Whereas if we go back to what I was explaining earlier, that to a large degree, I think that a lot of the cognitive models have it kind of upside down. So the theoretically, and there is neural circuitry that this is based on. The idea is that information comes into the brain from the external world, you know, what we see, hear, smell, and so on, comes to the thalamus, it goes up to the cortex where we become consciously aware of it, and then and only then it goes down to the amygdala and subcortical areas where we have where we determine emotional content and all this kind of stuff. So the idea is change our thinking, we change the signals going to the subcortical or the emotional centers, and we change our emotion and thus our behavior. Well, that's true, but it's missing a really big part of the story. So now if we bring in Dr. Pribram's whole model of emotion that he introduced many years ago, which makes this all make a lot more sense, at least to me anyway, is that in reality that there's neural circuitry right between the thalamus and the amygdala. So emotional experience occurs before the information even gets to the cortex. So in reality, emotions are much faster than thoughts. So in most of our life experience, we've already had the emotional, unconscious emotional perception, and then that's biasing the cortex. It's trying to justify what we already felt. Okay. Now, if we bring in the pattern recognition model I was talking about earlier, really what the higher cortex stuff is doing is monitoring the degree of match and mismatch and labeling the feeling. So I'm saying a lot here, and it's probably too fast and complex for a lot of listeners to follow, and I apologize for that. But the main point here is that if we can shift the rhythms of the heart, which we can do through what we call heart-focused breathing exercises and other self-regulation techniques, or even movement, things like that, we're shifting that afferent input to the brain, so which is going directly to the amygdala, and that's a bottom-up process that shifts the emotions and all that, of these same processes. So it's a much easier thing to do. And then we're also starting to shift that baseline, whereas through the top-down processes, none of that's really going on. It's just mind on mind. So we really target shifting the emotions. You know, this is really easy to see if you use like one of the devices called an M-Wave or Air Balance, one of our devices, or anybody's HRV monitors. You can think yourself blue. Not much happens to our body, to our physiology. But as soon as you feel something, positive or negative, that's when big changes happen in our hormones, in our heart rhythms, our blood pressure, and so on. Okay, I hope that was somewhat coherent the way I explained that.
Yeah, I followed it really well. But I think it was a great explanation. It's exactly explaining why the aim is to change feelings and not just thinking, and it's incredibly difficult to get any kind of consistent change just through trying to change thinking, which is, I think, most people would experience and know that as well. So that's fantastic. Thank you so much for explaining it in so well. So how about we talk more about your research in the effect of this? Maybe talk a bit more about the electromagnetic field and how far it kind of spreads out away from the body, and how we basically are affected by other people, like because of our electromagnetic field, we all affect each other, and the effect of relationships and so forth.
Sure, sure. So, starts with some basics here. When you go to the doctor's office, if that ever happens, they put electrodes across your chest to measure your electrocardiogram. Or if you're ever a research subject, they stick the electrodes on your brain to measure your brain waves. What those electrodes are measuring is a flow of current. So whenever we know from basic high school physics, right, that whenever you have a flow of current of electricity, you create a magnetic field. So the doctors measure energetics every day without knowing it, because every time the heart beats, it produces by far the largest magnetic field produced in the human body. Now, this is a literal magnetic field. I'm not talking about an aura or something here. I'm not saying they don't exist, but I can't measure an aura in my lab. I can measure magnetic fields quite reliably. In fact, it's exactly the same kind of magnetic field that your cell phone produces to send signals, you know, to the cell tower and back, or any kind of communications equipment as far as that goes. So the magnetic and electric fields are two different things. we call it electromagnetism because one field can make the other, and they're not interchangeable, one can make the other. So anytime there's a flow of current, you make a magnetic field. Now, magnetic fields, especially lower frequency ones, penetrate things. That's why cell phones work inside of buildings, right, where electric fields are pretty easy to shield. So the magnetic field of the heart radiates external to the body, and we measure that field with a device called magnetometers. And the sensitivity of today's magnetometers, you can measure the heart field about 3 feet away from the body. Using the same piece of equipment at the same settings, you can measure a brainwave about an inch away outside of the body. So that gives you the difference in the magnitude of the fields we're talking about here, inch versus 3 feet. Now, that doesn't mean the field doesn't go farther. Of course it does. That's the sensitivity of the instrumentation to detect it in a noisy world right now. So what we've also found is when we measure these fields, that they act as carriers of information, and especially our emotional information. As I kind of reflected, I don't know if I said this earlier, but our emotions are reflected in the rhythms of the heart. I mean, anxiety looks different than frustration, which is very different than love or compassion and so on. So we can it's called spectral analysis of these fields, magnetic fields, and pretty much tell with about 75% accuracy somebody's emotional state. So think of it in the same way you would a cell phone. You create what's called a carrier wave. That's the magnetic field, which carries information. So in the case of our cell phone, it's the picture, the text, the voice, whatever we're choosing to encode, that rides on that field. So it turns out the heart's doing the same thing, or our physiological system's doing the same thing. It's just the heart's the big carrier wave. So the next step, and once we figured that all out and got onto that, and this is going back quite a few years, in our research path, it was to say, okay, we know we're radiating this stuff. Do we detect it from other people? And as it turns out, our nervous systems are exquisitely tuned into biologically generated fields, not so much other man-made stuff, but the things that it's a very narrow window. So we're exquisitely tuned into these heart-generated magnetic fields of other people, as are animals. So we can quite literally measure a energetic communication going on, like sort of an energetic dance between people when they're in conversation or just hanging out, whatever. And we've got some great examples of this. It's especially fun to do it with animals. So we've got fun little examples of dogs and horses, and their HRV, their heart rhythms, quickly respond to the emotional state of humans, for example. So it's really neat to see that going on. So, and then other experiments have been done that shows this like I said, this physiological linkage or communication channel that's going on. So this is a communication that's occurring at the energetic level, and it's completely independent of things like body language and voice tone, which of course carry, we read emotions through those things. But even when people are isolated from that, let me ask you, Nikki, you probably had the experience. You go to a friend's house or even a place of business, and you walk in and you can just feel that something's amiss before any of those other cues occur. You know, a kind of common thing is you could feel the tension and you could cut the tension with a knife, right?
Yes, find it. I can particularly notice it with like bad energy at airports. That's one of the worst ones, yeah.
Yeah, so there's this energetic sensitivity. Now, on the other hand, it can feel really good to be in some other around certain people or in certain homes and things, right?
Mm.
So we're able to actually measure this now, which is really kind of neat.
That's profound. Well, it's so profound because the implications are, I mean, it's a statement that Tony Robbins says about who you hang out with is who you become. And that has deeper meaning in the context of your research.
Sure. And we've also shown, another study, it was independent of us, but based on our earlier findings, really nice, well-done, well-controlled study. It took groups of 40 people, and they had them in groups of four around a table, and I'm monitoring all their physiological signals and all that. And basically, three of the people were trained and used the M-Wave devices, which is a way of training yourself how to be more coherent for 2 weeks, so they're not big experts, long-life experts or anything. And then the fourth person in that group was naive. They didn't know what the experiment was really about. So the three people were signaled at random times. It was a very well-done protocol. I won't go into all the details, but long story short, when those people shifted into a coherent state, it had a measurable impact on the person who had no idea what was being studied. So in other words, when we're coherent, or incoherent as far as that goes, we're creating a field environment that literally affects those around us.
So this is why, not only is that really important when we consider the kind of clinician-patient relationship, just so that this is the healing impact that a clinician can have just because of their state with patients, which is really important, but also very important for, I found, with fatigue patients. If they're, you know, being at home and perhaps being around people that are kind of, I've been using this word like energy vampires, and it's possible these people really do exist now because.
Oh, yeah.
They're totally right. And this is so important because it can be a factor of why someone's not recovering, and they can do everything else brilliantly. You know, could be doing diet, could be working so hard and changing their state, but they constantly go, sometimes unfortunately, back home. And they've got this, you know, a home environment where they've got some very unhealthy relationships going on because someone's constantly in a lower state, and it's really important. It sometimes it can be the factor they need to address to recover.
Absolutely, I mean these energetic field environments, that's what they are, can be very important. Now at the same time, yes, you're right, but there are things that we can do, and it takes some practice, but to be able to maintain our own coherence even in the presence of other incoherent energetics. Now, of course, if somebody's in a really toxic environment or relationship, I mean, there's only so much you can do there.
Yeah.
But there are things we can do to really help protect ourselves and to maintain our own composure and our own energetic coherence, which can go a long ways.
Fantastic. So wonderful. It's also connecting in with, we'll be talking a lot more with some other people on the summit as well about sort of dealing with it emotionally and psychologically. So here we have the science behind it as well, actually explaining it from an electromagnetic perspective, which is amazing. So also, do you want to just share in this, we have these fields around us and now the amazing and fascinating research that I absolutely love that you're doing in terms of how we're being affected by the electromagnetic rays on the earth and beyond that. We so often, this is such an ignored area, I think, because we kind of think we almost exist in a vacuum that's kind of unaffected by where we live, that we're on this spaceship Earth and that we have a sun, you know, that's shining every day, and we don't consider these factors, and yet they're profound impact on health. You get the floor.
Okay, well, I have to be very brief here, because to really dive into that is a whole interview in itself.
Okay.
To be honest.
Yeah.
But basically, it's called the Global Coherence Initiative, for anybody that's interested, which has a lot of components. One is to help educate people about the Earth's field environments and what they can do to maintain their composure. And that's really what a lot of the HeartMath techniques are all about, is to be able to maintain our own self-regulation and our both personal energetic composure, if you will. So what we're doing in the Global Coherence Initiative on the science side is we're installing a global network of ultra-sensitive magnetometers around the Earth that are designed to measure what I call the resonant frequencies in the Earth's magnetic fields. Now, it's really interesting. I wish we didn't have to do this ourselves, but there are other magnetometers, of course, NOAA and different places out there, but they don't measure the resonant frequencies. They measure the strength of the field and kind of the noise or ripple on the field level. But as it turns out, I'm going to have to make this kind of a long story very brief. Mm. There are two primary magnetic fields of interest, but they're more than this, but that are generated by the Earth. So we know we have the geomagnetic field, which is the thing our compasses tune into, which is absolutely critical for life on Earth. Without that magnetic field, there would be no life as we know it on Earth. Earth would be very Mars-like very quickly. But in that field expands hundreds of thousands of miles out into space. But think of what are called field lines. And if you remember back to high school or junior high, whenever it was, you got to dump iron filings on a glass plate and put a magnet under it. I think a lot of people had that experience. And you see all the iron filings magically line up, right? These little lines are drawn. Those are called flux lines. And as it turns out, whether they're real or not, they are real. And if you think of the Earth's magnetic field lines as guitar strings, when you pluck a string, it vibrates, right? And that's exactly what's happening with the Earth's field lines, and what's plucking the Earth's lines are what's called the solar wind. So they're always there, they're always vibrating. And as it turns out, one of the primary resonant frequencies of those is exactly the same frequency, 0.1 hertz, of a coherent heart rhythm in a human being. It's exactly the same. So they all overlap. There's many of them, at Benefont House, the solar wind pressure and so on. They all overlap the cardiovascular system and the rhythms in our autonomic nervous system. Exactly the same frequencies. Now we have another magnetic system, and that's the thing called the ionosphere, which surrounds the planet, a big kind of soap bubble, if you will. And the bottom of the ionosphere is like a mirror. It's reflective of low-frequency magnetic waves. So the magnetic waves that get created in this cavity between the Earth and the ionosphere, they're called Schumann resonances, and there's eight of them. And the first one is 7.8 hertz, which is the same as the alpha rhythm in our brains. As it turns out, all eight of these rhythms overlap brain waves. So I'm trying to make a kind of a long story short here. Basically, the Earth is singing away 24/7 at the same rhythms as our heart and brains operate at.
So that's fascinating. And yeah, it's too much, obviously, to go into this, but the implications being things like, I think, does this what it would be things like some of the electrosmog that we might have that might block those frequencies, and even things like earthing technologies. Is that that maybe will kind of link into circadian rhythms? Is that the kind of the explanation about why those things are important?
Not so much. Now, okay. I'm familiar with all those things. They're important. In fact, one of our big supporters, unfortunately, he just passed away last year, was Dr. Franz Hallberg. He's on our board for the Global Coherence Initiative, and those, a lot of people may not know that name, but you mentioned circadian rhythms. So Dr. Hallberg coined the term circadian rhythm in 1948. So he was a great supporter and one of our collaborators. So these are important things, but it's not exactly quite the parallel as its grounding and so on.
Okay. But is there a ways that people can enhance, like Schumann resonance, like you have these pulse electromagnetic frequencies? Or
Maybe. I don't know. I think what we're really looking at, I think, is that's a much bigger, well, I shouldn't say it that way. I think a more important thing that we're at least looking at is basically what I was talking about earlier, Nikki, about how the Hertz field carries information, and we have this communication going on between us, like at the living room level.
Yeah.
Really, we're suggesting that the same thing's going on at the global level, that we all couple to the Earth's magnetic field, which creates a global information field.
Okay.
So we're doing a bunch of studies right now that clearly show that these resonant frequencies affect us in actually more profound ways than we ever thought we would see. It seems like every week one of our collaborators or some of our own data is like, wow, we just did not expect this to be so profound. But the data is showing that we're profoundly interconnected at a much deeper level with each other and the Earth than what we even expected to see. And we expected to find some things. Obviously, we wouldn't do all this. So I know we're running out of time here. So what I would like to encourage the listeners to do is to be more, say, mindful or heartful of what am I feeding the field?
Wow, yeah.
Right? But in each moment, that's probably too much to ask, but at least each day, try and remember, put up a sticker on your mirror or something. What am I feeding the field? How much am I feeding the global field environment is really being kind to my coworkers and others and compassionate and, you know, the loving and all the stuff we're talking about that feeds the field more coherent frequencies, because that affects all living systems on the planet, if we're right about this, versus how much am I feeding the field, you know, with my impatience and frustrations and because I didn't get my to-do list done, you know, fast enough and so on.
Fantastic. And people want to know more about that specifically. You have a website for the Global Coherence Initiative?
You can access it through the HeartMath Institute website. That's a little bit easier to remember. So just heartmath.org is a great website. There are hundreds of research papers there that you can download for free as well. And lots of books and, you know, access to the technology that allows people to train at home how to become more coherent. And just, you know, one of the things I'd like to really just remind everybody, hopefully I've been talking about it or it's come through today, is this is really learning how to self-regulate, but from a deeper inner reference point that's more connected with, through our heart, our deeper self of who we really are, you know, our soul, spirit, nature. So we didn't get into that. We have a lot of research suggesting that the heart really is connected to that deeper part of ourself, and that the the great religions and philosophers have been right all along.
Well, we've got 5 minutes left. I would just briefly ask you a tiny bit more about that. Yeah, if you're okay with that.
Sure.
Fantastic, because I think it can be so important, this idea that if somebody is, they have a health crisis, for example, and in terms of like sort of the resilience to get through something like that, the idea that we might have, that there in truth there is a sort of deeper spiritual part, maybe an expanded consciousness outside the normal human kind of consciousness, that we can, when we get into a coherent state through the heart, that we can connect with that, and that this would give us guidance or just the ability to keep going through very difficult times. And you've got a little bit of research you've done on this too that could potentially back that.
Quite a bit of research on that, actually. Okay, so we call it the original studies were called the electrophysiology of intuition. And if we only have 5 minutes, I can't go into detail, but these are very rigorous laboratory-based studies. And what we've basically shown is that the heart, I call it intuition. So for me, the flow of information, I'm going to tell you what the research shows rather than describing the research to save time here. But it's basically to suggest that intuition is really the flow of information. And it depends on what word people are comfortable with, their spirit, soul, higher self, higher capacities, larger self, whatever. But that is a real part of our undivided wholeness, and that it exists in another dimension. And that's what we really mean by heart intelligence, is accessing that dimension of our deeper selves, which is who we really are. And that literally communicates with the energetic heart and then the physical heart. So what the experiments show is that the heart responds first up to these intuitive signals in these experimental paradigms. Then the heart literally sends a measurably different signal, neurological signal, to the brain, and you see the brain response and then the body response. And now the research also shows is that when we're able to get into a more coherent state, which is largely done by being more appreciative, loving, compassionate, right, that quietens the middle of noise, and couples us to a deeper, we have a deeper connection to that internal signal from our higher self, measurably. So we have more access to that intuitive guidance. And now this is a whole other interview probably by itself to really get into the types of intuition, because there's really three primary types, and it just gets confusing if we don't really spell it all out. But so we call this a non-local intuition, to have a scientific term. But this is the type of intuition that you can't explain through implicit processes and energetic sensitivities and so on. That really does come from that deeper part of ourself. So, and that's really when I said earlier, this is really about learning to self-regulate from a deeper inner reference point. That's what I'm talking about. Because for most people, it doesn't work to be more in charge of ourselves, if you will. It's really about alignment with the deeper part of who we really are. And to do that, the fastest way to do it is to learn how to self-regulate the emotions, because it's the language of intuition. And to be able to bring us into our moment-to-moment guidance, we really do have to quiet the mental chatter, if you will, and the emotional turbulence to really be able to hear the deeper voice within.
Fantastic. So, and people can find out much more about you, everything you do, that you've got some amazing interviews and research published on heartmath.org, and I encourage everybody to go to that website to have a look at Dr. McCrady's work, which is absolutely fantastic. So thank you so much for your time today. It's been such a great pleasure to have you on the summit. It was one of the best that we've had, and very important, and I hope our audience is going to appreciate everything you shared with us today. So I just want to thank you so much.